So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Nikolai Naumov, who is a behavioral science specialist that looks specifically at the impact of behavioral science on service design. Hi, Nikolai. How are you doing?
Hi, Adrian. Thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. Now, so you also told me earlier that I should call you Nick, so I'm going to call you Nick rather than Nikolai. But Nick, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a bit about you and also a bit about the work that you do?
Okay, so I'm Nick Naumov, and I'm a behavioral science specialist who tries to apply this wonderful field of science in the area of services, particularly in service design. Mm-hmm. And I probably should explain a bit what behavioral science means. So behavioral science is the, let's say, branch of science that studies decision-making, judgment, and human behavior.
Right.
So if we think about service design, in a service, there is always a human component, at least on one of the sides. Even if we're talking about designing a machine that will interact with humans, at least on one side, there are people, there are humans. And, whether we call them customers, citizens, clients, or employees, or whatever, in the end, these are human beings. And there is a field of science that has studied and studies how humans make decisions and what influences their behavior. So I'm trying to connect this, body of scientific knowledge to the practice of implementing and actually doing service design.
Okay.
The aim, in the end, is to have happier customers or more effective services and even more profitable services.
Fantastic. Now, you recently published a book called It Makes No, and Knows in Brackets, Sense. And then the subtitle is Between the Joy of Gaining and the Fear of Losing. Can you tell me a little bit about the book and how it came about and sort of why you wrote it?
Yes. Quite interestingly, I didn't intend to write this book, at least not in the beginning. I started working on text support materials for the training programs that I provide.
Okay.
So at one point, after about 4 or 5 months of working on this, I've realized that there is so much material in there and it's so well structured that it can be a book in itself.
Okay.
So I worked in total on the book, on this book, in total for about 14 months.
Right.
So there is a lot of research and a lot of work that went into it. And what for your listeners who have encountered other behavioral science books like Predictively Irrational or Thinking Fast and Slow, I didn't try to write a better version of these books because they are truly wonderful. So there's no way to write a better masterpiece. What I tried to do was to give a bit of structure and to this field of knowledge, because there is a lot of knowledge, yet at least in let's say more popular books or non-academic books, there isn't that much structure. So I tried to give some structure and an overview on the main findings and on some secondary level of importance findings.
Okay. I mean, in the book, I think that one of the things, apart from the vast amount of knowledge there, in the book, you also talk about this thing where you talk about a 4D model of human behavior, and that we should always take into account all of the different factors in the model when considering how people behave or how we interact with them, how we engage with them, and how we'd like them to behave, whether they're, whether they're citizens, customers, or employees. I mean, can you give us a little bit more of an insight into the model and the 4D element of it, what all the different factors are?
Okay, so usually when you think about human behavior, we tend to believe that somebody does something because of their character, or if you want, in psychology language, of their personality.
Okay.
And also we assume that this that an instance of behavior is the product of cold reason judgment.
Right.
So basically, if somebody cuts in line in front of you at the supermarket, you know, you might say that that person is, well, I'm not sure on the language that I'm allowed to use, but, well, I think jerk is decent enough.
Yes.
But that might not be the case. It might be that somebody is on a terrible rush and they have a sick relative who needs something ASAP.
Right.
So it might not necessarily be, the behavior might not necessarily be the product of only the individual's personality and cold reason judgment. There are a lot of more other elements that come into play.
Okay.
Now, so the interesting thing is that personality or an individual's character is indeed a source of human behavior. At the same time, it is the weakest predictor of human behavior because personality refers to long-term patterns of behavior and not necessarily instances of behavior.
Right.
So for the benefit of your listeners, you know, in a service interaction, quite often we do not, we have to do with an instance of behavior and not necessarily a long-term pattern of behavior.
Right.
So, if we want to understand what drives human behavior, we can use this 4D model, which basically says that there are four major drivers of human behavior.
Right.
Two of these drivers are related to the individual, to the person, and two drivers are related to, let's say, the outside of the individual, the environment.
Right.
So, one driver, as I mentioned, is personality, yet personality is a very weak predictor of or influencer of human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, that is also related to the individual, refers to, let's say, transient internal states. Basically, you can be hungry, you can be tired, you can be fresh, you can be sexually aroused or not.
Yes.
And so on. Also, it's about what salient identity you have at a point in time. So,
right.
For example, a store that sells, let's say, product for children might see an adult customer as, you know, as a client, as a customer, and so on. Yet, probably, if that person is male, you know, most likely his salient identity at the time is that of a father or of an uncle or of a grandfather, maybe.
Sure.
Right. So, and for the shop, the individual is a client, a customer. However, the client and customer has the salient identity of a father or of a grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and also this is related to personas, right? We tend to in service design we tend to focus a lot on who the customer is or who the prototypical customer is, which is absolutely correct, yet if we focus too much on who this person is in terms of personality traits, then we tend to ignore all these transient factors, right? So
right.
When you come off, you know, eight hours flight, you know, most likely you're not in the same state of mind and even in the same physical state as in, you know, at 9 a.m. when you enter the office.
Yes.
Okay. So these are the two drivers of human behavior that are related to the individual. Now there are two other drivers related to the context, and one of them is the social dimension or social drivers.
Right.
You know, humans are a social species, So we live in societies, we live in communities, we have relevant others. Because now we live in, I live in a city that has about 500,000, 600,000 people, and this is, well, let's say a rather small city for Western Europe.
Yeah.
But, you know, in all this city, out of all the people living in the same city, I have only a couple of people who are relevant to me, the rest I don't necessarily care.
Yeah.
Okay. And what happens in terms of human behavior and social influences is that most likely we are going to imitate what other people similar to us or relevant to us do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this might not be big news since the research on the social influences is, I think, more than 50 years old. But okay. Also, there are influences of authority figures, And also there is social competition. And this part of social competition is quite often ignored. But, you know, I'm not going to take the pleasure away of reading the book. And yeah, I will stop here with the social dimension.
Yeah.
And the fourth driver of human behavior is the physical environment.
Yes.
Now, the physical environment can be, for example, related only to the design and composition of a choice set, so or of a form that you have to deal with, and the way in which a choice set is designed and its composition strongly influence what people choose. Now, this doesn't mean that each and every person will choose the same thing, but you know, we can have disproportionate choice shares, or if you want, preference for a certain option if we design the choice set in a certain way.
Right.
Second, there is also the, let's say, actually sensorial environment, or the influences that we perceive through our senses, and usually we are absolutely unaware of these things, right? So if you go into a waiting room for, I don't know, let's say a public service, you might not necessarily notice the scent that is in that room.
Right.
You might not necessarily notice the music that is in that room. You might not necessarily notice the, let's say, shape and texture of the chairs, or how the chairs are arranged, and so on. All right. But all of these things influence what we think, or actually how we think.
Yes.
And influences what we do.
Right.
So, I mean, in terms of sensorial influences, for example, retail, I mean, there are retailers that, well, know these lessons very well. I'm not entirely sure if they know how they work, but they know that they work.
Yes.
And you probably noticed that basically there is no such thing as a bakery with perfect ventilation from the ovens.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly.
Somehow, the scent of freshly baked bread is always left to enter the room, or even get out on the street right in front of the shop. You know, this is how bakeries sell.
Yes.
And, you know, also in supermarkets, you know, at least in the Netherlands where I live now, the bakery in the supermarket is in the area where customers, go through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the area where they chop the meat is behind closed doors.
Yes.
It's not something that is necessarily a very, very useful to increase sales.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And there's a whole different sort of factors, and it makes the whole sort of issue actually, there's dimensions there that I think that we many businesses might do something about, but some that they actually don't sort of necessarily think about. But I mean, I was reflecting a little bit more on the book. I mean, by your own admission, the book is like a mini encyclopedia of behavioral science, and it's not necessarily a handbook on how to apply sort of behavioral science in service design. So, I mean, I must admit, I've scanned some of it, but not gone through all of it because there's so much to it. But I think one of the things I'd like you to do, if you could, is help us understand some of the big lessons that can be learned from behavioral science and how that can be applied to service design and customer experience.
Okay. So the book is indeed a mini encyclopedia. It covers the, let's say, the main findings in behavioral science, and also gives a brief overview on, let's say, some other secondary level of importance findings. Yet there is a lot more out there.
Yeah.
In terms of knowledge, and Ethan, the main learning is that you are not talking to Mr. Spock when you are providing a service.
Yes.
You're the person in front of you is not without emotions, and it's not without at the same time it's not without reason. Don't get me wrong.
Sure.
A lot of behavioral economists tend to say that, you know, we humans are more like Homer Simpson, and not exactly, but we are not computing machines that, you know, have a body.
Yeah.
And in terms of service design, and service design is a lot about human behavior, right?
Yes.
We might want people to do something, or I want to avoid them doing something. And I recently had a talk with somebody who deals with safety on oil platforms, right?
Right.
So, you know, that's literally life and death and millions of euros risks. And, you know, in such a case, it might be interesting to prevent people from doing something, instead of encouraging them to do something.
Yes.
It's also about choice. It's also about decision making. We want to make choice easy, but at the same time, you know, we'd rather have people choose the product for which we have a higher profit margin.
Yes.
So for all of this, there is a lot of knowledge on how people behave and how people make decisions. I think it's very important to understand it because, as I said, in the end, services and service design are about human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for example, I like to make this analogy. If you just want to build a small shed in the back of your yard, you don't really need to know geometry or physics. You just need the common sense.
Yeah.
But if you want to build something that will last for a few hundred years and it's a lot more than a shed, you'd better know physics and geometry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's quite similar with service design and behavioral science. Here, behavioral science being the physics and geometry having the same role as in physics and geometry in building. Now, if you open a small shop, you don't really need to know all of these things. Common sense is quite often enough.
Yes.
But if you want to do a, let's say, service design masterpiece, you'd better understand how humans work.
Yeah.
In terms of work as in working for somebody, but you know, what are the mechanisms behind human decision making and behavior.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, in your experience, I mean, do you think that that organizations are really starting to embrace these type of insights and use them? And do you see the demand for these type of insights kind of going up? And if not, kind of what's stopping firms actually kind of like embracing the behavioral science, the insights from behavioral science and applying it to service design?
Well, as in, let's say, any broad market, you can find everything. You can find companies that integrate our organizations, sometimes being government organization or NGOs, that incorporate these insights to actually pretty big level.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, it's quite a small market at this time. It's growing slowly, but it's growing.
Yeah.
And on what prevents? Well, at least in my experience, there are two things that prevent, let's say, a larger scale adoption of these insights.
Yeah.
One is that these insights are, well, at least in, let's say, the mainstream, they are relatively new.
Right.
Although in academia, they are not necessarily that new.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that is new and intriguing and counterintuitive is very appealing until you actually have to do it.
Right.
I mean, in terms of listening to talks and that's covered. The problem is when you actually have to do it, and there's a lot of inertia. And I'm not sure if it's fear, but it might also be, well, let's say, it takes an extra push to make the final step into actually implementing. And second is that although these insights from behavioral science can lead or can produce interventions that are relatively cheap. I'm not saying that they are free or that they are necessarily very, very cheap. But there is a huge asymmetry in terms of input and output. You know, playing classical music in a waiting room is not very costly. Yet, the decrease in the level of annoyance for people waiting, for the people who are waiting there, is a lot bigger that could be that than it could have been obtained with the same amount used on something else.
Right.
However, as I like to say, behavioral science is a gold mine for service design.
Mm-hmm.
But in a gold mine, you will not find gold bars.
No, that's very true.
And you need to extract the ore and refine it, and this is not necessarily it's not necessarily a straightforward process. You need to test, and in order to test on what works, it also implies failure, right?
Yes.
Because if we design, let's say, 5 possible interventions on, let's say, decreasing the level of annoyance of people who are waiting in a waiting room for a public service or whatever, for sure, not all 5 of them are going to work best. That's natural.
Mm-hmm.
One of them will be the best, and probably one of them will lead to more annoyance instead of less annoyance.
Yes.
And in order to find the best one, you need to test. I mean, even the best the best knowledge from science and from practice cannot predict everything.
Yes.
At one point, you need to run a randomized controlled trial, or if you want, an experiment. This is not very complicated, honestly, but it involves the possibility of failure, which a lot of let's say decision making people in companies are not eager to expose themselves to.
Right. Okay. I mean, that makes sense. I guess the one thing that comes from this is that a lot of people mistake the idea of science as being the provider of the one definitive answer. And I guess what you're saying here is that actually science isn't about that. Science is all about experimentation and about pushing the boundaries and our understanding of that. And behavioral science isn't immune to that. And therefore, to take this on, we need to be willing to experiment and find out with what works within our particular service area or our particular domain of business or our organization, I guess.
Indeed, and at this moment there are some findings from both academia and from applied science that have been proven for many times.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so one of them is loss aversion. Right, people are going to be more motivated to avoid a loss of 100 euros than they are going to be motivated by a possible gain of 100 euros.
Yeah.
And that is pretty much, that's beyond any doubt.
Yes.
At the same time, a lot of the knowledge that exists in both academia and, let's say, applied science part has been proven to work in a certain context.
Yes.
Right? Usually, the knowledge from academia comes from controlled laboratory studies,
mm-hmm.
which are absolutely great, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, even if the results from the academic study are beyond doubt, we have to see if they actually work within your context.
Yeah.
For example, I will give an example here. We know that, for example, we know that diffusing the scent of chocolate in a bookstore leads to an increase in sales for romance novels or for romance books.
Okay.
And that's once you know it, it's quite obvious. It's quite hard to figure out beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are selling car parts.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to increase, the sales of a certain product. What kind of music or what kind of scent are you going to use? Because car parts are definitely very different from books.
Yes.
And
I guess there's all sorts of kind of insights, but as you say, people have got to experiment to try and find out what works for their particular context.
Yes, that is the truth. And as you mentioned earlier, the book that I published is a mini encyclopedia, not a handbook, because I don't believe that there is such a thing as a handbook of applying behavioral science into service design.
Yeah.
Because each, or at least there are some broad categories of services, and it's quite difficult to have a clear framework or a clear handbook on what works in each and every situation.
Excellent.
I mean, for example, now I'm working on a project on insurance or let's say on insurance product.
Yeah.
And one of the things that one of the issues for this company is, you know, how do we get people to think a bit more about their future? And this is very hard.
Yeah.
And this is very hard, especially for, let's say, the most vulnerable categories, and this is, let's say, low-income categories.
Yes.
And, there are solutions, not ideal, not 100% effective, but there are solutions. Yet, this might not work in, I don't know, transport service or something else, on another area of service.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Nick, if I think about the book and things, and if I think about somebody that was listening to this and thinking, yeah, we should, they were thinking about their organization and thinking about how they could apply the insights that come from behavioral science into their designing a better service or the improving their customer experience. I mean, what top tips would you say, would you give them about where to start for our readers and listeners?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. Where to start? Start by admitting that you have to do or you have to deal with human beings.
Right.
Not customers, not users, not whatever. Human beings have very, let's say, fundamental needs that are universal.
Yes.
I'm not going to go very deep into that, but that is a, let's say, at least in my view, it's a truth beyond any doubt.
Yes.
Second, start reading on the subject. My book is not necessarily the best book you can read as a first reading in the field, and it's not intended to be like that.
Mm.
It's something like a second or third book that you read in the field. Though, please do buy it and look through it. And third, admit that there is no perfect solution unless you explore all the, let's say, scientifically informed options and subsequently test them.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I can give you an example from the Behavioral Insights Scheme, which is part of the UK government.
Mm-hmm.
And this, let's say, unofficially it's called the Nudge Unit.
Yes, indeed.
And what they managed to do was to increase the rate of enrollment in the organ donation registry for UK citizens.
Yeah.
And the intervention that proved to be the best was to frame the message as follows. If you are willing to accept an organ transplant, assuming that you need it, please do register in the organ donation registry.
Right.
Okay. And this is what is known by every UK citizen who renews their car insurance, or I don't know exactly, they will be faced with this message.
Mm-hmm.
And it works, and it's the best intervention that they've done. What is less known is that I think there were 9 interventions
right.
that were tested.
Right.
And honestly, even if I know a lot in this field, I couldn't have predicted that this one, exactly this one, would be the best performer in terms of effectiveness. Because there were some other interventions that had positive influence on the enrollment rate, but not as big as this one.
Right.
And so, and quite interestingly, the intervention that said, if you support organ donation, please do register, did worse than just asking people, please do register.
Interesting.
So, what is intuitively correct, as in, if you support organ donation, act on it,
yeah,
actually did worse than just saying, please enroll.
Right.
Yet, some other things that were not necessarily very intuitive, such as, if you'd accept an organ transplant, please do register as an organ donor. This is not necessarily the most intuitive way of framing the message.
Mm.
But this one was the best performer out of, I think, 8 or 9 interventions. Wow. So even if the people who worked on this project were probably among the best practitioners in behavioral science in the world, nobody could have predicted which exact one or precisely which one will be the best performer. So you need to get scientifically informed insight and then test.
Excellent. And so, Nick, my final question that I always ask people that come on the podcast is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Yes. I'd like to invite your listeners to visit my website, naumov.com, and take a look at the workshops and at the masterclasses sections. There's a lot of nice training programs there.
Mm-hmm.
And also look for behavioral design and behavioral science information sources. My book is one very good source. There are some other wonderful books. And also read my blog, naumov.blogspot.com. Surprisingly, some very big guys in the field read it constantly. But it's accessible for non-specialist readers as well.
Well, I mean, thank you for that, Nick. And I know that I came across your work via Graham Hill and Wim Rampen. And hence that's why I invited you on here. And so I just wanted to say, I'll get all of those things linked up to your website, your blog, and to the book and things, so that people can then go and check that out and find out more about it. But I just want to say thank you for sharing your insights today. And yeah, that's fascinating. I think behavioral science and how it intertwines with service design and customer experience is an area that I think we've only just touched on, and there's a lot more to learn from it. So I just want to say thank you for coming on the show today. That's been great.
Okay, thank you, Adrian, for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you.